Silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Well, good morning. It looks like we have some students who have joined us. My notes tell me that Wisconsin Lutheran High School students and their advisors are here. If that's correct, would you please stand? Very good. Please be seated. Well, the students are here on a project called Court with Class that we operate in conjunction with the State Bar. So they've heard a little bit about the case that you're going to be arguing to us today. And when this argument is concluded, Justice Annette Ziegler, who sits right down here, is going to stay afterwards and talk to the students and anybody else who wants to stay to hear her conversation, not about the merits of the case, but really more about the process by which cases come to the Supreme Court and answer questions of the students about that. So please stay if your group permits you to do that. I know you often come on buses and sometimes you're not overly flexible, but we'll move right along here and hopefully you'll have time to hear Justice Ziegler when we're concluded. Okay, are you ready to proceed? Okay, then I'll call our second case for the day, Midwest Neurosciences Associates versus Great Lakes Neurosurgical Associates. Please begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Joan Huffman. I represent Dr. Yashda Panu and his LLC, Great Lakes, and I'm with the law firm of Chuck Glass, Erickson, Nonville, and Larson, SC. This case...
Counsel, I'm not hearing you. I don't know if my colleagues are having trouble, but I'm having trouble.
All right. Can you hear me now, Your Honor?
Our marshal is going to come try to help with the mic a little bit.
How is this, Your Honor?
Yeah, I think that's better. Thank you very much.
This case arose relating to the enforceability of a redemption agreement between the parties, an agreement that has no arbitration clause in it, and which not only has no arbitration clause, but has express language in the agreement that's irreconcilable with the duty to arbitrate anything. And the fact that the parties, that the plaintiffs are disputing the enforceability of that contract caused them to persuade the Court of Appeals that, regardless, the parties now have to arbitrate all disputes between them. They need to not only arbitrate the underlying merits of their non-compete obligations, but disputes about whether a prior arbitration agreement with one of the parties is still in effect.
Well, counsel, can you help me out with the order of events that we have to address? So there is an operating agreement, correct?
There was an operating agreement among the three members.
Right.
It is now in effect with respect to the remaining members because there's been a redemption.
Right. So we all agree that there is still an operating agreement. Part of
right.
Your question
We're not
is
contesting
whether...
that the operating agreement doesn't apply to anybody at any time. We're saying that our interest in the company was redeemed, and this agreement continues to operate among the remaining members.
Right.
Succeeded to our interest.
Right. So I'm trying to work with me on the order of events for a moment. So it seems that Midwest is suggesting that the order of our analysis looks like this. First, let's look at the operating agreement because that has the non-compete. And at least at one point, Dr. Panu was a party to that. And so and that has an arbitration clause, right? And so we need to figure out what the operating agreement has to say about the obligation not to compete. And then after that, then we'd look at whether or not this redemption agreement has any validity. Talk to me about that. Is that the order we should engage in?
No, Your Honor. The issue here is whether or not the parties entered into a redemption agreement. There's nothing in the language of that contract that says that that issue is something to be arbitrated at all.
Okay.
There's nothing
in
the
agreement
that says...
If the redemption agreement is valid and effective, that will affect the non-compete obligations, right?
It will, yes.
Okay. And the JAMS rules that were incorporated in the operating agreement, doesn't that say that anything that bears on the continuing validity of the agreement that is subject to arbitration has to be determined by the arbitrator?
There is a provision in the operating agreement that talks about JAMS rules. There's several issues going on here, though. First off, Dr. Panu never was a party to the arbitration agreement. So regardless of what the arbitration agreement says, he never agreed to arbitrate anything.
Okay, is that a genuous argument, though, or is that some... the opposite is disingenuous. Isn't that disingenuous? Because isn't Dr. Panu the only member of Great Lakes? And we're talking about a non-compete clause to which he specifically signed. I mean, that's the crux of this. So to say it somehow doesn't, he's not bound by the rest of the agreement, he's only bound by the piece that talks about non-compete, he signed on behalf of Great Lakes, right?
He signed on behalf of Great Lakes in an official capacity on behalf of Great Lakes.
And Great Lakes is only him, correct?
Great Lakes, he is the principal, and in his official capacity, you know, he can bind Great Lakes to that agreement.
Is there anyone else in Great Lakes besides Dr. Panu?
No, there's not.
Okay.
He's the sole member. But what they're trying to do is they want to also arbitrate his individual obligations vis-a-vis.
Well, the issue that was raised in front of the court was the non-compete issue. So that's what's in front of the court. The response to that is the non-compete issue is in the operating agreement to which all parties, Dr. Panu on behalf of Great Lakes, agreed that arbitration applies and the JAMS rules applies. So when you're challenging the validity of an agreement and not the validity of the arbitration clause itself, we have case law and we have the JAMS rules that both point us to that going to the arbitrator, correct?
There's a lot there to unpack, and there's a lot of distinctions that need to be made here. I think what you're referring to, first off, is the Buckeye case.
That is one of them, yes.
That line of cases is distinguishable. In that case, there wasn't an issue of whether or not the parties consented to an agreement. It was an issue of whether or not, despite the fact that everyone agreed that there was an agreement among the parties, whether or not that agreement was enforceable for other reasons. And the party had made a challenge based on the fact that it was a usurious contract under state law, and the court said, no, you have to make a challenge specifically to the arbitration clause. You can't challenge, there's no guilt by association.
Counsel, let's perhaps look at it this way. Let's assume for a moment that we still do make a distinction between LLCs and their members as far as liability on contracts signed by the LLC. Dr. Panu signed an acknowledgement acknowledging that he was bound by the non-compete provision, correct?
By the non-compete provision, and they very well could have...
Yeah, hang on. So in that acknowledgement, that was appended to the operating agreement, yes?
It was attached to the operating agreement, not necessarily part of the agreement itself, I would say. I would also say that because it said that he is bound by the non-compete provisions, they didn't say, and he's bound by every other provision in his individual capacity.
But
they could very easily have drafted that language to say, and he's also bound by the arbitration provisions. They chose not to do that, and they're stuck with the contract that they drafted.
But wasn't the non-compete provision freighted with the obligation to arbitrate any disputes over it?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I heard the question.
Sure. Wasn't the non-compete provision freighted by the obligation to arbitrate any disputes over its effectiveness?
If you're asking whether or not the arbitration provision was broad enough to include non-compete issues, it would be with respect to Great Lakes, because Great Lakes also agreed to the arbitration provision.
Right, but the arbitration clause essentially, and I'll just paraphrase it, and I don't think it'll do any violence to the agreement in doing this, but the arbitration clause says, look, if you got an issue with the enforceability of the operating agreement, it goes to arbitration, right?
Right.
Essentially,
with respect to the operating.
And that includes the non-compete provision, yeah?
That would include the non-compete provision.
Okay. So if that's an overlay on the non-compete provision, then, you know, how can Dr. Panu agree to the non-compete without without the overlay?
Well, I mean, it's very simple. He could agree to not compete with Midwest, and that those any disputes would be litigated in the circuit court with respect to his individual obligations.
Is that your argument? I didn't understand that to be the argument in the brief. Are you also arguing that Dr. Panu, that we shouldn't even look at this agreement as a whole, the operating agreement, that the only thing he's bound by is this provision where he signed the non-compete?
With respect to Dr. Panu, absolutely, because he didn't sign anything else binding him individually.
And nothing else in this operating contract would apply to that non-compete clause. So you're saying we just look at that by itself without the arbitration provision?
Correct. And you have to remember he also signed his own ancillary agreement, which basically reiterated all the non-compete provisions, except for it didn't have any arbitration clause in it. So they could very easily have drafted an ancillary agreement, which operates as a standalone agreement, that would have operated to compel him to arbitrate his own individual obligations regarding competition, but they chose not to do that.
Are you relying also on the acknowledgement at the end of the operating agreement, which said, by the execution hereof, each of the undersigned agrees to be personally bound by the provisions of 8.13?
And 8.13 is the non-compete provision.
Okay.
And we're contending that bound by 8.13 means bound only by 8.13. It doesn't mean by the entire rest of the agreement. Otherwise,
there would have been no reason to add that at the end
right,
of the
it would
agreement.
Have been superfluous to say that he's bound by 8.13 because that would have already been a foregone conclusion.
Okay, but above that, where Justice Rogancic was reading, it does say, by their execution hereof, each of the undersigned hereby personally guarantee the obligations owed by the respective entities. So you're discounting that also?
I'm not discounting it. I'm saying that it's not being read the way that it should be read.
How should that
what
be
that
read?
What that agreement says is that if Great Lakes has an obligation under the agreement, then Dr. Panu has an obligation to ensure that Great Lakes meets its obligations. You know, in other words, if there were an obligation for Great Lakes to arbitrate, he would have to make Great Lakes participate in the arbitration. It doesn't say that Midwest can all of a sudden subsume into that any individual disputes that it has with Dr. Panu outside of that. You know, part of it is we need to understand the way doctors are credentialed. It's just like lawyers are credentialed. I'm not licensed as Joan Huffman of Douglas, Erickson, Bonneville, and Larson. I'm licensed as Joan M. Huffman. And so regardless of my affiliation with my law firm, I am a licensee. So I can practice somewhere. Now, we don't have non-compete agreements with attorneys, but it's the same sort of idea with doctors. Doctors are credentialed as themselves. They're credentialed with a hospital as themselves, not with someone else. So these non-compete obligations that they're contending under the ancillary agreement include, you know, anything that he has in his individual capacity outside of Great Lakes.
So, counsel, even by personally subscribing to Section 8.13, Dr. Panu did bind himself to other provisions in the contract, right? So, for example, members, as that term is used in 8.13, and company, as that term is used in 8.13, are defined somewhere else other than 8.13, right?
Right, you know, okay. the capitalized terms that would be used,
So we need to have reference to other parts of the contract to understand the obligations of 8.13, yes?
Definition section, clearly.
Okay. Now, the acknowledgement didn't say that he'd be bound by the definition section, just said he'd be bound by 8.13. And yet, we understand by that he's bound by the definition section, too. Yeah.
Well, that's because you can't understand that provision without reference to the definition section. You can understand perfectly what the non-compete provision says without reference to the arbitration provision. So, I mean, that doesn't subsume in every aspect of the contract. And again, they wouldn't have had to have talked about 8.13 individually if they meant the entire contract. They would have said that he signs on as a signatory to the contract, and there also would have been no separate reason for him to sign an ancillary agreement, which he did.
Right. But perhaps that's because they didn't really, weren't too concerned about binding him to the transfer and payment of purchase price provision of 8.10 or time and place of closing of 8.9 and so on.
You're right.
So
I'm unfortunately having a lot of difficulty hearing you.
Well, let me just move this over a little bit. So perhaps they called out 8.13 specifically because they wanted him obligated to those provisions, and they weren't terribly concerned about things like the transfer and payment of purchase price provision of 8.10 or the time and place of closing of 8.9 or any of the other provisions of the contract as a substantive matter. But as a procedural matter, perhaps they understood this obligation not to compete is freighted, overlined with the obligation to arbitrate any dispute over its meanings.
Your Honor, we interpret contracts by the words that the parties use.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't speculate as to why they used those words or what they meant or why they might have included them. You know, that's all beyond the scope. And the provision is unambiguous that he's signing on to 8.13, and that's it.
Right. So in your position on that is that it is a non-compete provision that is not freighted with anything else related to those provisions.
Right. There's no other baggage associated with it.
Okay. So you say that, and now Midwest says the opposite. So how are we to determine whether it's freighted with the duty to arbitrate or not?
Well,
what's the principle we apply?
I think what you're trying to say is that non-compete obligations means non-compete obligations anywhere in the contract. And if that were the case, it wouldn't have focused in on non-compete obligations in a specific provision.
No, what I'm trying to say is that your position is that the non-compete obligation doesn't come with any superstructure.
Correct.
Right? And your opposing counsel says the non-compete obligation does come with some superstructure. So what I'm trying to figure out is what is the principle by which we determine whether there's superstructure here included or not?
Well, the principle is to just look at the terms of what was said in the agreement. It says 8.13. It's unambiguous. There's no superstructure mentioned or even hinted at.
Counsel, even if Dr. Panu did not have to arbitrate any dispute about the non-compete, he still has a non-compete obligation under 8.13, correct?
He would, yes. If
And then you're going to want to step into the redemption agreement, correct, where you think that Dr. Panu got rid of the obligation to non-compete by that agreement, correct?
Right, and that's exactly what Section 7 of the redemption agreement says.
I understand that, but what troubles me about it, and maybe you can address it, is he's the only one who signed it. And the other side said, hey, there never was a meeting of the minds. I never signed it because I never agreed. What are we to do with something that changes an agreed-upon provision of a contract by another contract to which the other contracting party said, I never agreed and I never signed it. That shows I never agreed. So what do we do with that?
Well, I think you need to distinguish between whether or not they agreed and whether or not they signed. As a matter of basic contract law in Wisconsin, a signature is not required to bind someone to an agreement.
Right, but an agreement is a factual matter. You can't argue that to us.
I'm sorry?
Whether there was an agreement is a factual matter. We are a court of law. We don't find facts.
And the circuit court did find those facts, though, and it held that they did agree to the agreement. And so...
So we would have to think that it was clearly erroneous in order to step aside from that agreement. Is that your position?
Absolutely. You would have to find that there's no theory of the facts that would make it reasonable for the circuit court to decide what it did.
Okay. Thank you.
Was there a check that was cashed in this case?
Yes, there was. In this case, part of the performance under the redemption agreement was that we were to tender a check to Midwest for Great Lakes' share of various wind-down expenses, and there was an offset to that based on the redemption of his membership interest. There was also a check to a company called Sikich, which was the administrator of the retirement plans. As of March 31st, everything other than moving out, which was to occur on April 30th, had been completely performed in this case.
Wasn't the check returned? Over here. Wasn't it returned?
No, I'm not sure returned is the right word. They tendered a check after full performance of the agreement.
How soon? Well, their argument is that they didn't realize what the check was for. So how soon after did that happen?
I don't recall when after full performance the check was tendered and rejected. But in any case, it has nothing to do with whether or not my client performed under the agreement. Our argument is that performance of the agreement, you know, at a minimum, extinguishes any of these other arguments they have regarding the enforceability of the redemption agreement. They accepted full performance. You know, they can say performance when the obligation is to tender a payment is when we give the check to them. That's our performance. What they do with it after the fact, that's not our performance. That's whatever they do. And in fact, they did negotiate the check. They negotiated the check prior to the April 8th text message conversations between my client and Dr. Ahuja on the one hand and the attorney for Midwest, who was attorney Francis Hughes, in which both of them, you know, essentially reaffirmed that there was a redemption agreement. In that case, or in that text message, our client had said, well, hey, can you get me your signed copy of the redemption agreement? And he responded, sure, I'll work on it when I get back. He was evidently off-site somewhere at the time of that message. And then he went on in that text message to say that there was an issue with getting out of the lease, which was another part of the redemption transaction. And he said, but I'll take care of it. So he was reaffirming those terms of the redemption agreement. Also, Attorney Hughes had said, you know, the only thing we're waiting on is the signed documentation from Sikich. In other words, as soon as we get the documentation from Sikich, which, you know, was something that was entirely on their end, they were going to give us the signed agreement. So again, that manifests in an intention that, you know, this was going to be signed. Everyone agreed to it. I do want to go back for a minute to what we were talking about earlier with the Buckeye line of cases, because I think that's led to a lot of confusion in this case. Buckeye didn't say that you couldn't challenge any provision of an earlier agreement other than the arbitration agreement. What it said was that you had to make a challenge that was specific to the arbitration agreement. Clearly, an arbitration agreement is not usurious, so a challenge to the contract based on usury, for example, doesn't say anything about whether the parties continued to have an agreement to arbitrate. And in the Granite Rock case, for example, the court was very clear that even though the party challenging arbitration was challenging both that they had an arbitration obligation and that they had violated a no-strike provision. But the issue of whether or not the collective bargaining agreement had been entered into or agreed to in the first place was something that had to be resolved by the court as a threshold issue, because the linchpin in any case of arbitration is consent by those who are to be bound by the arbitration. You know, it's all well and good to talk about the scope of an arbitration clause, but when the scope of the clause is not what's at issue, but rather the very existence of whether you have a clause, that's an entirely different issue. And what this Court of Appeals did here completely turned the Town Bank decision on its head. Town Bank is very clear that when you have a merger clause in a written contract, you don't look outside the terms of that contract as to what the parties agreed to. You don't look at...
But counsel, we have a dispute here over whether or not the redemption agreement was in fact formed. So my question for you is, how do you get around Rule 11B of JAMS, which says that jurisdiction and arbitrability disputes, including disputes over the existence and validity of the agreement under which arbitration is sought, are matters for the arbitrator to decide?
Well, I mean, again, that's relating to the agreement that the arbitration clause is a part of. The redemption
right.
agreement is not part of the operating agreement that the arbitration clause is a part of. It's an entirely different contract.
It is, but the parties are disputing which contract applies, whether the operating agreement is still in effect. And so since the operating agreement has the arbitration clause, isn't it up to the arbitrator to decide in the first instance whether or not it was superseded by the redemption agreement?
No. The issue of who decides whether a clause is arbitrated is treated differently from the question of whether something falls within the scope of an arbitration clause. In that case, there is no presumption in favor of arbitration.
It's not a presumption. It's what the parties contractually agreed to if the operating agreement is still in force.
And, you know, one, Dr. Panu never agreed to anything regarding his individual obligations. And the question of whether or not an arbitration provision is in effect, you know, that goes to the very issue of consent. The court said in the Granite Rock case that consent is, you know, the first issue. When there's any question about whether or not an agreement to arbitrate continues to apply, that's for the court to decide.
Except if the parties, the parties can contract around that, though, right?
And if there's any ambiguity, you know, certainly when there's an issue, as there is here, of whether or not there's a second agreement. I'm sorry, I'm out of time. Do you want me to reserve
that
for my rebuttal?
No, please finish answering the question that Justice Bradley posed.
You know, as the Riley case pointed out, if there's any ambiguity and the evidence of a second agreement itself creates an ambiguity, at least when there's language in that agreement that is inconsistent with arbitration, then you have the ambiguity there, and so you no longer have a presumption that this needs to be arbitrated. The burden is on them to show that we have to arbitrate, and so the burden is on them to show the redemption agreement is not applicable.
Very good. Thank you. I think you're going to need, before you start, to pull up the podium. There's a lever on the right.
I haven't found it.
Yeah, so that we can hear you better. This room is really hard to hear in, and we try and try with new mics, and it never seems to help. There you go. And then if you put the microphone so it's a little below the level of your mouth, usually that works, so we'll see.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Patrick Harvey, and I represent Midwest Neurosciences Associates, LLC, and Neurosurgery and Endovascular Associates, LLC. The reason we're here is because the trial court committed two fundamental errors. The first error was that the court denied my client's motion to compel arbitration. The second error was that in the same hearing, the trial court granted a declaratory judgment motion which the court conceded was essentially a summary judgment motion. Now, that summary judgment order was issued before a single document had been exchanged between the parties. It was issued before a single deposition had been taken in the case. And the only evidence that the court had in front of it were two affidavits that were conflicting in all material aspects that they could possibly be. Now, fortunately, the Court of Appeals corrected both of those errors, granted our petition for interlocutory appeal, and reversed the court's order in full.
Okay, so the circuit court made a factual finding?
Factual and legal findings.
Okay, but a factual finding that there was an agreement such that there wasn't actually a redemption agreement between or among the parties.
I think that's a trickier question because the legal theory, and it was an oral ruling, and so it's difficult to really tell, and the legal, you know, for instance, it seems like the court was hinging on apparent authority, but apparent authority wasn't used in the hearing transcript, so I'm not entirely clear. I think it was partially factual, partly legal, but it was incorrect in both aspects. And the reason, the motion to compel arbitration was a bigger problem for the reasons that the court...
Counsel, before you get there, just so I understand the facts on the ground here, did the Court of Appeals conclude that the alleged redemption agreement was not valid?
The Court of Appeals did not issue a ruling on that. It stuck with the motion to compel arbitration, and it said, in light of the court's error on that issue, we're reversing the poll, and you are to go to arbitration.
Okay. So whatever the circuit court said about the validity of the redemption agreement, that still stands?
No, I don't think that's correct. I think the order was vacated in full, and the court or the parties are to proceed to arbitration, because otherwise there would be nothing to arbitrate. There would have been no point in the Court of Appeals order if the summary judgment ruling was still
where, where in the Court of Appeals decision does it vacate? It said order reverse and cause remanded with directions, but did it vacate the entirety of the circuit court's decision?
The circuit court's order was contained in one order, and it said the order is reversed.
Right. Reversing an order doesn't necessarily mean that it gets vacated, right? It gets reversed on the point of law that the Court of Appeals addresses.
I think that's a question that maybe we need to look at the Court of Appeals hearing transcript, because this was an issue we went over. This was an odd case. We had oral argument in the Court of Appeals. And one of the questions they asked was, if we reverse the Court of Appeals or the trial court's arbitration decision, then that effectually takes over the whole case and you guys go arbitrate. And I think that's what the Court of Appeals was trying to do.
Okay, but generally speaking, I mean, work with me on a hypothetical here. If we reversed what the Court of Appeals wrote, not what it discussed in argument, but if we reversed its decision, what it wrote, that would reinstitute the circuit court's order, right? And the circuit court's order included a conclusion that the redemption agreement was valid.
Correct.
Right. So help me understand how the Court of Appeals simply reversing the order acts as a vacator with respect to the court's findings on the validity of the redemption agreement.
I don't remember the date of the circuit court's order. I want to say it was March 15th. We'll just go with March 15th. The order was a March 15 order, and it said, I'm finding as a matter of law that the motion to compel arbitration is denied, and I'm finding that the redemption agreement is now valid and enforceable, and, you know, the rest of it.
Right.
The Court of Appeals said we're reversing that whole March 15 if that's the date order.
Isn't what you're addressing now kind of the essence of what Judge Riley's concurring opinion addressed? It seems to me, arguably it is. That is, he espoused the freedom of contract and in a footnote specifically dealt with the redemption agreement and said he... argues that the redemption agreement was a valid and enforceable contract. This is footnote one. As I read the Court of Appeals opinion, they did reference the redemption agreement, but they indicated that the redemption agreement didn't address the validity of it per se, but rather that to say that it would supersede embraces the merits of the arbitration issue, and that was their analysis, as opposed to addressing the validity of the redemption agreement itself. Did I make myself clear, and do you agree with what I said?
I think so. Let me make sure, though. I think you're right. The Court of Appeals said it's a merits question, and that's why the Circuit Court isn't allowed to make that order.
Yeah, that's exactly what I tried to articulate, that the Court of Appeals did not opine on the validity of the redemption agreement. That was not part of their analysis. Their analysis was really to kick it back, if I may say that, to the arbitration arena, because they said, the majority said, the very issue of whether or not it supersedes, that is, whether it's valid and supersedes, is an arbitration issue, an issue for the arbitration arena. So they didn't address the validity of it.
I agree with that. I'm sorry if I wasn't clear earlier, but yes, and the Court of Appeals was absolutely right to do that, because they correctly said under Wisconsin law, under Cirilli, under Mortimer, even under this court's 2015 First Weber decision, there's only two questions we're supposed to be asking, and to go beyond that is to get into the merits of the dispute. So the Court of Appeals said, we're not going to do what the trial court did. We're going to answer those two questions, and then it's going to go to arbitration, and the arbitrator can deal with it.
Did the trial court find that the redemption agreement was entered into by the parties in a valid agreement?
Yes. I believe that's part of the trial court's order.
The trial court or the Court of Appeals?
Trial court.
Trial court.
Okay.
You know, I understand what you're saying, and the Court of Appeals appeared only to deal with arbitration, but they have to basically set aside the operating agreement to do that, because paragraph 7 of the operating agreement says release of non-compete restrictions. PANU parties are currently subject to non-compete restrictions contained in the operating agreement and in the ancillary restrictive covenant agreement dated March 6, 2006, in consideration for the terms of this agreement, PANU parties' restrictions against competition are hereby released and made void. So doesn't the decision of the Court of Appeals have to set aside the trial court's decision that this redemption agreement was a valid contract between the parties, or what do you do with that paragraph?
And I want to make sure I'm clear. Paragraph 7 of the redemption agreement?
Yeah, that's what I'm reading from. Page 6, paragraph 7. Yeah.
Yes, I think, yes, that's what the Court of Appeals was doing. It was saying, trial court, you don't get to make the merits decision, and a merits decision is, in this case, did the redemption agreement take effect? That is the quintessential merits decision in this case.
So, counsel, is the arbitrator
I didn't hear the end of his answer yet, Justice Kelly.
So, yes, I think that's what the Court of Appeals was doing. It was saying, we're reversing the trial court's order in full and saying it's going to go to arbitration, and the arbitrator is going to make a determination on whether the parties entered into this redemption agreement.
Okay, fine. Thank you. I understand now. Go ahead, Justice Kelly.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, counsel, the redemption agreement did not address just the non-compete provisions, correct?
I'm sorry. I didn't hear you.
The redemption agreement, if it exists, it didn't address just non-compete obligations, correct?
Yes, there were other issues dealt with.
Right. So if the arbitrator has the authority to determine the validity and effectiveness of the redemption agreement, what happens if he finds that it's not valid? What effect does that have on all of the other obligations contained in the redemption agreement? Do those all go away?
Yes, they're a nullity.
All right, so because the redemption agreement happens to touch on, as a subsidiary matter, the non-compete obligations, that means the entirety of that contract is subject to an arbitrator's authority to decide.
It's subject to the arbitrator's authority as to?
To decide any disputes over, let's say there was a dispute about compensation paid under the redemption agreements. The arbitrator would decide that, too.
Yes, it's a broad arbitration clause, and his power stems from the operating agreement, and it says any and all disputes arising out of the operating agreement.
Okay, but the redemption agreement doesn't arise out of the operating agreement. That's a separate agreement, right? This is in effect, a negation of the operating agreement, if it is effective, right?
If it is effective, which we didn't sign it, so it's
right.
Not.
So what I'm saying is let's say that the dispute is not over the non-compete provisions, but the dispute is over the compensation that is required to be paid under the redemption agreement. Is that subject to the arbitrator's authority to decide?
I don't think we're in arbitration if the arbitrator makes the decision that the redemption agreement is valid, because if the arbitrator says, you guys entered into the redemption agreement, it's enforceable,
that wasn't
the
arbitration's
over.
That wasn't my question. So let's say the dispute was over compensation due and owing under the redemption agreement. Is that dispute subject to arbitration?
Because the arbitrator would have had to make a precursor finding that it's valid, then no, it's not, because there's not an arbitration provision in there.
So once you enter into something that requires arbitration, you can never enter into a subsequent contract to undo that requirement?
No, that's not our position.
What would they have had to do?
If there was a fully executed second contract that clearly knocked out the arbitration clause, parties are free to do that. We, of course, didn't sign this one because we didn't agree with it, but parties are free to do that. But there's an important add that I think we should add here, and it's important that I get the import of the question that to be a little bit like, isn't it unfair that we're sending them to arbitration anyways, even if there's a second contract? And it's not, because if there's clearly a second contract, it's executed and it clearly knocks out that first provision, that's going to be a short arbitration.
What I hear you saying, though, is that any subsequent contract would go to the arbitrator to decide whether or not it's a valid contract.
Correct. Under the law, under
no
Wisconsin's
what.
Under Wisconsin's current law and under the Supreme Court law, yes. But again, it's going to be a short arbitration if there's a fact scenario like that, which this one doesn't present.
Even if you had different parties, they would be subject to arbitration? The arbitrator determining if their subsequent contract was valid?
That's a murkier area, and it would depend on what parties, and there's a lot of factors, I think, that would go into that question.
Counsel, the dispute here, really, between the parties arises over whether or not the redemption agreement superseded the operating agreement, right?
Correct.
And isn't the crux of your argument resting on JAMS Rule 11B, which under the operating agreement the parties agreed to be bound by?
Yes.
And in that provision, as I mentioned to your opposing counsel, it says jurisdictional and arbitrability disputes, including disputes over the existence or validity of the operating agreement, are to be submitted to and ruled on by the arbitrator.
Correct.
So when you're I just want to make sure that you didn't concede something you didn't mean to. You weren't saying that just because the parties entered into this arbitration agreement under the operating agreement at one point in time, that everything under the redemption agreement, if it were valid, or any other agreement the parties entered into, that the arbitrator could decide that, right? It's only when the existence of the operating agreement or its validity is in play, as it is here, right?
Yes.
Isn't that just a matter of focus, though? I mean, which one, that's what your opposing counsel started with, you know, what's the focus here? And, of course, she says it's the redemption agreement, and you say it's the operating agreement. Let me ask this, though. Let's say the redemption agreement said we specifically contract in this redemption agreement that we do not want arbitration, and we specifically disavow any governance or guidance by Rule 11, interpretation of rules and jurisdictional challenges set forth in JAMS. What's your position then? Because you argue that always the operating agreement will control. Even in that instance, does the operating agreement control?
Under current Wisconsin law, there's a two-step analysis. So
the answer is yes.
Correct. And the same is under federal law.
So doesn't that really hit upon Judge Riley's concern that you talk about freedom of contract? I've said specifically the same parties, we do not want to be covered by Rule 11 of interpretation of rules and jurisdictional challenges. We specifically contract this day that we want to be governed and ruled and adjudged by a circuit court's determination, not an arbitrator's determination. Your response is, well, too bad. It still has to be go back to arbitration. It'll be a short arbitration. That's your response. So the party's subsequent contract with specific language has no moment.
My response is, yes, it's a short arbitration, but more fundamentally, there's a reason we're speaking in hypotheticals, because that case never ends up in this court.
But we've got to figure out how this works.
I don't think he finished his answer, Justice Kelly.
Yeah. Go on.
Just briefly, if there's a clause that's that clear and it's that obvious, no one's going to push for arbitration. What's the point of wasting the money?
Because of the interpretation of the law that you say exists. Because of Mortimer and Cirilli, they will.
And the federal law. But I'm saying as a practical matter, that case never matriculates up to the court, because I'm sure that happens on a daily basis. And parties just say, I'm not going to go to arbitration in this instance because it's that obvious. That's why we're speaking in hypotheticals.
But we have to figure out how this works. So I think your answer then to Justice Rebecca Bradley's question is that once you agree to arbitrate an issue, you must always arbitrate that issue, and you can't contract out of it, right?
No, that's not what I'm saying. You can contract out of it.
But if the question is, okay, so let's go back to Justice Ann Walsh Bradley's hypothetical. You have a subsequent contract that says we specifically disavow any obligation to arbitrate this agreement, and you say that still has to go to arbitration.
In theory, yes, but okay, in reality, it's probably not going to happen.
But only if the parties are disputing whether or not that second agreement is valid. If they don't dispute that the second agreement is in force, no one's going to go to the arbitrator, because it's not an issue, right?
But there might be an occasion where someone can delay of even a couple of days or weeks make a world of difference in a dispute. I mean, there might be that occasion, and just merely saying, I didn't really agree to that which is clear and unambiguous, is enough to send it to arbitration?
Under the current state of Wisconsin law and federal law, because under Buckeye check cashing, once you concede, you've entered into this arbitration agreement, and they've conceded that here, then the only other question is, are you challenging the arbitration clause itself? They're not. They haven't. So in that situation, federal law is clear, and there's preemption issues that are hovering around this that need to be factored in. But again, I think Justice Bradley is absolutely right. It's a practical question that if there's a clause that's that clear and it's fully executed, you're not going to waste time with the arbitration. All right, and there's sanctions available in arbitration, and you might get sanctioned for something like that.
So let's do this. Let's say that this gets challenged, the redemption agreement. The arbitrator says the redemption agreement is not valid, right? And therefore, you know, we apply these non-compete obligations. And Dr. Panu says, wait a second, the redemption agreement wasn't just about non-compete. It was about a whole lot of other things. It was about me selling my interest in the company. And I think this is, you know, and I want that to be enforced. And so then he goes to state court and says, I've got a redemption agreement, and it requires the company to pay me X for my share in the company, right? Can you do that?
I think there'd be some estoppel issues in that scenario.
Right, which means that the arbitrator was deciding issues that had nothing to do with the non-compete.
But the arbitrator is the one that gets to make a decision under the terms of the party's operating agreement contract. The arbitrator gets to make the decision about whether the operating agreement is still in place or whether the redemption agreement is in place.
So let's say this wasn't about non-compete. Let's say it was just a sale of an interest in the company. Yeah? And the redemption agreement gets signed, but Midwest says not valid. So we're not talking about non-compete at all. We're talking about a sale of an interest in a company. That has to go to arbitration?
I'm sorry. I'm not sure I'm following your Honor's hypothetical.
Right. So I'm taking this outside the non-compete context, because you know, Dr. Panu signed the acknowledgement, and there's a question about whether he, you know, agreed to the arbitration provision there. So let's just say that he did. But the dispute now is not over non-compete. The dispute is over, let's say, Midwest didn't pay me what it agreed to pay me under the redemption agreement for my interest in the business. Does that go to arbitration?
I don't know if there's a buyout provision in the operating agreement, but if there is, it arises out of the operating agreement, then yes, it goes to arbitration.
Well, doesn't their entire relationship arise out of the operating agreement?
Yes.
So anything to do with the relationship would have to go to arbitration.
Right. Is that right?
Yes, because of the arbitration provision. It says any and all disputes arising out of the operating agreement or the party's obligations they're under goes to arbitration.
So they can't execute a subsequent contract that touches on any aspect of their relationship without it going to arbitration?
Correct.
Counsel, are you sure you want to concede that? Because, again, I think there's a significant caveat here, isn't there? It's only if the parties are disputing whether the second agreement supplanted the first.
Yes, subject to what I said earlier. It depends on whether they're going to dispute the second agreement. And most of them aren't. If it's that clear that we've signed the second agreement, we specifically said we're not arbitrating anymore, something along those lines, you're not going to go to arbitration because it's a waste of time, and you're probably going to get sanctioned.
But we are not necessarily to assess what someone seems to be practical or impractical. Our role is to develop and apply the law. And your interpretation of the law that you're advancing to this court, based on Cirilli and Mortimer, under the law, that's their avenue to go to arbitration, practical or impractical.
Yes, and this court's first Weber decision from just a couple of years ago said there's two questions you ask. If you go beyond those two questions, you're wading into the merits of the dispute and going back to Joint School District 1977, and the federal law says the same thing. Courts have consistently held the court has no business weighing into the merits of the dispute because the parties agreed to have the arbitrator decide all decisions, not merely the ones that the court deems meritorious, not merely the ones that the court hints that might be meritorious. All disputes go to the arbitrator because that's what the parties bargained for. And it's consistent with federal law, too. And again, there's preemption issues hovering. Granite Rock is very clear on this point, and I'm glad that counsel brought that up. Granite Rock says under federal law, if you want to challenge an arbitration clause, you have two and only two options. You can come in and raise a formation challenge and say, I never agreed to this arbitration provision in the first place. So that's option one. Option two, you can raise a Buckeye challenge. You can challenge the arbitration clause itself. If you don't raise one of those two specific challenges, you have to go to arbitration. Anything else goes to the arbitrator.
Okay, so essentially your position is today is that the redemption agreement itself arose out of the party's relationship under the operating agreement. So that's why the redemption agreement's questions go to the arbitrator.
Proposed our redemption agreement.
Yeah,
yes.
Well, okay. And I agree, another position you have is there never was an agreement. But if there were, it'd still have to go because it arose out of the operating agreement.
Well, and more fundamentally, we filed the complaint, and we filed non-compete allegations pursuant to Section 13.7 of the operating agreement. We are the master of our pleadings. So the dispute that we're asking to arbitrate is our claim under the operating agreement.
Okay.
This
Thank
is
you.
The defense that they're raising.
So it sounded to me when counsel was talking that she was arguing more of a formation challenge, that Dr. Panu was never a part of an arbitration agreement, and so because he didn't sign it, is that the argument that was made at the lower court level, or was this a Buckeye challenge?
No, the Panu is a separate entity argument. Is that what you're referring to?
Yes.
That argument was waived. It was never raised at the trial court level. We filed an interlocutory appeal, so there was briefing. It was never raised there. It was never raised in the Court of Appeals merits briefing. We had supplemental briefing in the Court of Appeals. It still was never raised. That argument wasn't raised until the cert petition in this case. So that argument was waived.
Okay, and so you see this when you said there's two avenues. This is more of a Buckeye challenge, which would, under Buckeye and the line of cases following, need to be resolved by an arbitrator.
Exactly. They can't raise a valid formation challenge. They signed the contract. Formation challenge.
They're arguing now that they didn't, but you're saying that was waived.
Yes, it was absolutely waived.
Okay. Thank you.
To address a couple other points that counsel raised, Town Bank was brought up, and the argument was something along the lines of Town Bank forecludes, or because there was a merger clause in the redemption agreement, which we didn't sign, because there was a merger clause, the court can't look at the operating agreement at all. That's a misreading of Town Bank. Town Bank gets at the issue that Justice Bradley was raising, and I think it's paragraph 38 of the decision. Town Bank says you don't get the advantage of a merger clause or the parole evidence rule if there's a fundamental dispute about whether the parties entered into the agreement in the first place. And Dr. Panu hasn't cited a single case where this court, and I'm not aware of any, where this court has given life or effect to a merger clause when the agreement hasn't been fully executed. In Town Bank, it was fully executed. And in that situation, the court says, okay, well, once you've done that, once you've agreed that there's an integrated agreement, then we're going to pay attention to what the court or what the party said and enforce only that agreement. That's not what happened here, so we never even get to the Town Bank question. The other argument that my opposing counsel brought up is that Buckeye is somehow distinguishable, and I want to be clear that it's not distinguishable, because what they're saying now is, initially, we didn't raise a arbitration clause itself challenge, and the record's clear on that. Their initial request to the trial court was, trial court, find that the operating agreement as a whole is obsolete. And their response to our motion to compel arbitration likewise said, judge, you can't enforce arbitration because the whole operating agreement has been rendered invalid. And it was only after we kept citing Buckeye and explaining you pled yourself out of court and into arbitration by not challenging the arbitration clause, that then, because there was staggered briefing, they had a motion for declaratory judgment that continued. Then, at the very end of the briefing, did they come in and say, well, we're challenging the arbitration clause too. Buckeye doesn't allow you to do that. Buckeye says, if you raise a challenge, meaning one, that's the type of challenge that is aimed at the validity of the contract as a whole, you've pled yourself out of court and into arbitration. So Buckeye is not distinguishable at all, and it's controlling here.
Counsel, I want you, before your time is up, to address that same end of the operating agreement that I asked opposing counsel, and it's called the acknowledgement. And it basically is signed individually, where the operating agreement itself is signed in official capacities. The acknowledgement is signed personally, and they agree to be personally bound under 8.13. Why would they agree to be personally bound under 8.13 if they were already bound by the whole agreement?
And I want to make sure I'm understanding. Is the court's question why the two different guarantees? There's the guarantee above that and the acknowledgement.
Well, let's just focus on the acknowledgement first, and then we'll talk about the guarantee. Okay. Why are they personally being bound by 8.13 if the agreement already binds them? There isn't any need to do that. They would already be bound, right?
I suspect it's overkill. People get a little skittish about non-competes and their
enforceability. Well, that could be one explanation. Now you wanted to talk about the guarantee. Guarantee is also signed individually and personally, guarantee the obligations owed by the respective entities under here. Do you want to explain to me what you think that means?
Yes, that's exactly what I was going to say. If the court's willing to overlook the waiver, and I don't think the court should.
Well, let's just talk about the guarantee.
Yeah, that was exactly what I was going to say. By signing that, Dr. Panu personally guarantees all of Great Lakes' obligations under the agreement, including the agreement to arbitrate. And there's a separate signature page for Great Lakes, which he signed that one too. And here he's saying, I'm signing on behalf of Great Lakes. This page, he's saying, I'm individually and personally guaranteeing all of Great Lakes' obligations under the operating agreement. And that's in case Great Lakes goes bankrupt or something. He still has to do everything that Great Lakes has promised to do, including arbitrate.
Okay, and all right, I understand what you're saying. So, but it isn't meant to be financial obligations of the entities here. You're saying it's all the obligations that the entities bound themselves to by this agreement.
There's financial obligations in there, too. They had a shared employee benefit plan. So
sure.
That's exactly why. If something happens to Great Lakes, they've got shared employees. They need to have their health insurance.
I can understand it financially. And if that's where all it was limited to, I think it has quite a different effect on the outcome of the agreement. But what you're telling me is it bound these people individually, personally, not just financially, but to perform the obligations that the entities had to perform, and one of them is to have matters arbitrated.
Yes, and I think that's a reflection of, I see my lights on there.
That's fine. You finish your answer.
And I think that's a reflection of the fact that, as counsel indicated, the way doctors like this operate is through an LLC, and it's a single-member LLC, and it's to ensure that what needs to get done gets done.
Okay. All right, good. Thank you very much.
Your Honors, before we close, there's one thing. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, that may be a little high for you.
How about now?
Yeah, I can hear you fine. I don't know about my colleagues. I've had trouble today.
I'm okay.
Yes.
There's one thing that I want to make very clear. I mean, they're saying that we did not challenge the arbitration clause itself because we challenged the entire operating agreement. But the problem with that is that we did challenge the arbitration clause itself. Part of our challenge was that the terms of the redemption agreement waived expressly any obligation to arbitrate. And because we got to that, then as a domino effect of that, you get to the other issues in the case. And once you decide that issue, that leads to the idea that the operating agreement no longer applies with respect to our client. So it's not that we didn't challenge the arbitration clause. I think a hypothetical would be very helpful in this case in order to see that it's not just whether the operating agreement as a whole is valid or invalid or as to our client, whether we contracted out of it. Section 7 of the operating agreement, for example, has the clause that releases us from all non-competes. For a moment, let's just imagine that Section 7 said something a little bit different. Let's imagine that Section 7 said that we're released from our non-competes if Dr. Panu relocates his practice to St. Francis Hospital. In that case, the redemption agreement doesn't completely extinguish all obligations under the operating agreement. There's still that one thing that's retained, so it's not a Buckeye challenge, but our position with respect to the arbitration clause is exactly the same. The merger clause said that with respect to the subject matter of the redemption agreement, this is the entire agreement between the parties, so whether you're releasing the non-competes, retaining the non-competes, or qualifiedly releasing or retaining the non-competes, the redemption agreement still has as its subject matter the non-competes, so it's still the entire agreement that the parties have with each other relating to non-competes. And if there's no arbitration provision, then there's no arbitration obligation. I'd also point you to Section 6 of the agreement.
I'd like you to look at the guarantee that's on page 30 of the operating agreement, and it's the one that I talked with opposing counsel about. And the physicians who are the principals of the legal entities that signed this operating agreement, by their signatures, guarantee the obligations owed by the respective entities hereunder. So why isn't that an obligation to arbitrate?
Well, it would be an obligation regarding Great Lakes' obligations.
Well,
to
but
arbitrate.
That it says personally guarantee the obligations. So what you're saying is that they would have to force Great Lakes to arbitrate, but
right.
That doesn't personally make them subject to arbitration.
Right. I mean, he's guaranteeing Great Lakes' obligations. It's not creating any new obligations that don't already exist with respect to Great Lakes.
Okay.
It's not saying that he has individual obligations.
Okay. Thank you. That answers my question.
Well, wait, but if take it into the financial universe, you know, paying rent and employees' wages and things like that, when they personally guarantee that, they're not personally guaranteeing that they'll make Great Lakes pay that. They're personally guaranteeing that they'll pay it if Great Lakes doesn't, aren't they?
He's guaranteeing Great Lakes' obligation. The obligation is payment. So if the obligation is payment and he guarantees the obligation, then he guarantees that he will meet that payment obligation. It doesn't mean that he
right, and here it's the Great Lakes obligation to arbitrate, right? So the personal guarantee is that he will ensure that Great Lakes arbitrates.
Yes. Great Lakes has an obligation to arbitrate, which
right.
we're contesting, and that gets us into the freedom of contract here. Basically, opposing counsel's position is that once parties at any time in the history of the universe had an agreement to arbitrate, that my light's on. May I finish this?
Yeah, talk? You can finish the question.
That, you know, you're now condemned to arbitrate until the end of time, regardless of whether or not you expressly attempt to rescind or not. And the arbitration, Chapter 788 specifically states that if there's a defense to arbitration, that would be generally applicable to all contracts, and express rescission by both party is applicable to all contracts and does not single out arbitration, then you're now outside Chapter 788.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you for a very, very interesting case, both of you. The arguments were very good, as were the briefs. We're going to take a break now for the afternoon. Justice Ziegler will be out to chat with you all if you have a minute to stay, and so we will adjourn till our third case. The court is adjourned.